At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Luke Guerrero stands ready to take your finance and investment questions and share his unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors. Today is Wednesday, May 29th, 2024, and I'm Luke Guerrero, and I will be your host over this next hour for the Invest Talk program, where our main objective every day is to help you leave a better and more informed investor than when you got here. So how do we do that? Well, if you're one of our frequent listeners, you know that we bring some topics to the table. We talk about interesting things that we see throughout the day that may affect markets, that will ultimately affect you, or stories that can help you become a better investor or better at financially planning your life. Aside from that, more importantly, in my opinion, we hear directly from you. So this next hour, please feel free to give me a call anytime at 888-99-CHART because I love talking to you live. Now, before we run down the market today and talk about those show topics, let's answer our first caller question right now.
Hi, Steve, Justin, and Luke. This is Kay calling from New York. About a year and a half ago, I had called about INQQ, India Internet and E-commerce ETF. Just wanted to get your take on it now. Back then, you had told me it was good due to cultural norms, but with the population size in India and they're shifting to more industrial and growth and whatnot, just wanted to know what you thought. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So INQQ is the India Internet and E-commerce ETF. Whenever we look at ETFs, the first thing we want to know is how much are we paying for this ETF? Non-starter right off the bat. This one's about 86 basis points. The expense ratio is going to vary depending on many factors, the asset class, the country. India in particular is a more expensive market with higher regulatory thresholds, so they tend to be more expensive. 86 basis points, kind of on the more expensive end, but I would expect anything in India to be at least above 60. Now, its AUM is about $39 million in US dollars, and that's for an ETF. And so let's look at its exposure. So it gives you some pretty even exposure between large caps, mid caps, and small caps, roughly 35% large, 38% mid, and 26% small. It's primarily focused in finance, technology, and consumer services because that makes up 27, 24, and 21% of it, respectively. Now, thinking about the demographics of India, certainly that country is the poster boy, if you will, for growth, specifically within Asia, especially with Chinese demographics, something we'll talk about a little later on, and Chinese growth slowing. My problem with this fund specifically is that it appears to be pretty narrow. It is only investing in 26 names. The top three names are about 10% each. It's very, very concentrated, and you're paying a lot for it. So I think if you're wanting to invest in the Indian market, you should probably do it in a more broad approach that attacks the market as a whole rather than focusing on tiny aspects of it like internet and e-commerce. You're going to have more risk associated, especially within an underdeveloped market, or rather a developing market, if you concentrate in those smaller areas. So I would look for a more broadly diversified and therefore also probably cheaper ETF to get into the Indian market. But overall, I do like the idea given its growth dynamics. Thanks for the call. Now, we've got a lot of ground to cover in the next 45 minutes or so, and here's some of what I have planned for you, time permitting. My main focus point concerns this topic. Five key lessons taken from the study of U.S. financial history. Research compiled for a new book reveals five overarching themes, such as the appreciation of the bipolar peril of price instability and recognizing the long-wave cycles of alternative asset classes. This will be of interest to academics, trustees, institutions, and of course, to you. For this topic, we'll have to take a look at the U.S. financial history, how that has affected alternative asset classes, and what public credit value can tell you about cycles. We'll also touch on a new survey coming out of the Fed from U.S. firms that touches on the labor market, consumer confidence, and how they feel about the economy going forward. We'll also talk a little about OPEC and how their role has been shrinking over the past couple years with new oil growth coming from, of all places, the Western Hemisphere. And not only that, the targets that they've set to support prices, apparently individual members aren't even sticking to them. So we'll talk to you about that and how that has affected oil markets overall. And should we have time at the end of the show, we'll talk about the IMF's upgrade of Chinese forecasted GDP growth after the first quarter was better than expected. We also have some voice bank questions ready to play, including one on EXPE, Expedia Group, Inc., and DD, DuPont de Nemours, Inc. I also have some questions that came in to our comment section of the InvestTalk YouTube channel. And of course, I hope to hear from you live over the next 45 minutes at 888-99-CHART. Now we're going into a short break, and on the other side, we'll talk about today's market activity. Please remember, you can call anytime and leave your question on our InvestTalk voice bank. You know the number, 888-99-CHART.
InvestTalk callers make each podcast unique.
I was calling about Intel, if it's worth holding on to, or should I sell it?
Their questions are curious.
I have saved up around $80,000, and I was wondering what I should do to make it grow.
Careful.
Well, I'm just wondering, is this a value trap? Because it looks like it's gone down quite a bit.
Concerned.
It's taken quite the tumble today. I've been trying to get out of this position for a while. I think I waited too long.
And clever.
Looking at Dominion Energy, Inc., does seem to be situated in some areas of expanding population.
And Justin Klein and now Luke Guerrero are always ready with their unbiased answers.
And this is, it looks like a classic example of chasing yield. Don't chase the yield.
Next 12 months price to earnings is around 30. I just don't see it at this price.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART. This is InvestTalk, with more than 58 million downloads. Luke Guerrero is here now, taking your calls live. 888-99-CHART.
Let's take a look at how the market fared today. U.S. equities were pretty broadly lower in trading today. They kind of ranged in a narrow level for most of the day before finishing the session off at their worst levels. The Dow was down over a percent. The S&P 500 down 74 basis points. NASDAQ 58 basis points. And the Russell 2000 small caps almost 1.5%. Now, today marked another day where the equal weight S&P continued to lag the official index. How do we look at the equal weight versus the normal index? Well, the equal weight tells us more about market breadth. It takes every name in the S&P 500, weights them equally, which means price movements in each one will affect the index equally. So market breadth continued to be a problem today. Big tech mostly down, but only modestly lower. The notable laggards today were airlines, including American Airlines, managed care, energy, some asset managers, given the further hawkish repricing. Not a lot of groups did well. Treasuries were weaker, showing a little bit of bear steepening on the curve. The dollar was up 50 basis points. Gold finished down 60 basis points. And crude oil, West Texas Intermediate, settled down almost a percent, reversing some of its earlier strength. A lot of that, like I said, was driven by this rate backup. The big overhang on stocks as of late, made worse this afternoon by yet another weak treasury auction. Upward rate pressures has also been driven by the hawkish Fed speak and firmer data. And the Fed's latest beige book, which we'll be talking about, that consumer survey, noted most districts saw slight or modest growth, while two noted no change in activity at all. Looking ahead to the week, all eyes will be on PCI on Thursday, where the expectation is a 30 basis point month-over-month change and 2.82% year-over-year. The Fed has been saying, according to the recent talking points, that it's likely they will need to see really PCI prints in the range of 20 to 30 basis points for the foreseeable future before they begin to think about even being comfortable discussing cutting rates. Now that's the market today. So let's shift gears and go back to answering another question that came in earlier to our voice bank. You know the number, the place where you can leave your questions anytime, 24/7, 888-99-CHART.
Oh, Justin and Luke, I had a question about DuPont, ticker symbol DD, D as in David. So I was listening to my usual morning podcast, and I found out that DuPont is planning on splitting into three companies. Now, I bought DuPont less than a year ago at their 52-week low. They didn't do very well with sales in China, but they had mentioned that they were going to do repurchases of shares, and that it caused the stock to go further up. I think I'm up maybe 38, 39% of my portfolio, and it's only about like 1% of my portfolio. I don't like the idea that they're going to split the company into three, because that essentially breaks down the price of what the stock is going to be by these three different companies. And I don't essentially like being given the price. I like buying it at the price that I would like. I know that sounds a little confusing, but my question is, do you think I should sell DuPont or should I keep it? Let me know what you think. I'll listen on the podcast. Thank you very much and have a wonderful day.
So the question is about DuPont. There's a lot of questions here. But DuPont, for those who don't know, is a specialty materials, chemical, agricultural materials company. Recently, they've seen sales growth kind of fall off. And actually, I believe in the past 5 years, they had some activist investors come in who actually suggested, you guys are too big. Break apart the company. And this can be the case sometimes. Sometimes companies get too inflated. Sometimes there really aren't synergies there and they could operate better as separate entities. So that's what DuPont's doing. They are breaking apart their three divisions into an electrical division, their DuPont division, and I can't recall off the top of my head their third division. But regardless, they've seen a lot of softening demand for two reasons. One, a lot of their demand comes from China, about 20% from China. Secondarily, a lot of pent-up inventories from before the pandemic are now being depleted as demand comes back. So that's kind of a high level of the issues that DuPont has been facing. Now, that being said, I want to attack the heart of the question, which is you don't like that they're breaking up because the price will split. Well, here's the thing. If a company splits into three separate entities, generally speaking, I don't know the details of this specific corporate action, but generally speaking, the shareholders of the original entity will get part and parcel of the new companies. And so let's say you have a company that's worth $30 a share. On paper, those three entities should at least be worth something that equals 30. However, sometimes you get streamlined efficiencies. Sometimes it ends up that the broken apart entities are worth more than the sum of their parts. Sometimes it's worth less than the sum of their parts. Either way, you shouldn't be scared if a company is breaking up or spinning off. It is not as though shareholders generally will not get some equity in that next company, and they are made whole based upon their original holdings. Now, for you, you're up 38%. I think DuPont specifically has some issues with revenue growth. I think they have some issues with a little bit of debt, but not too much debt. But primarily, my main problem with DuPont is the problem those activist investors had, and that is it became too large, it became too bloated, and the company itself would be better served split up. If it were me, I'd probably wait and see what the entity looks like. I think the company probably has a better chance not being the big behemoth that it has been and not having the massive overhead drag down a lot of divisions. Thanks for the call. Now, whenever possible, we like to play two in a row. And because we still have some time before heading into the break, let's try that now.
Hi, Justin and Luke. I'm calling about Expedia, ticker symbol EXPE. I've owned this company for about a year now. I bought it back in June and I sold about 70% of it in December at a pretty nice gain. And I do own a little bit more. And I mean, after the earnings, it did drop. I am still up right now. And I look to try to figure out what I should do with it. I think in about 2 weeks, I will hit the 1 year mark. So I will be taxed slightly lower. So if you can just do me a favor and let me know what you would do just so I can prepare myself looking at the current numbers. After the earnings information. Thank you very much. Have a good day. Best wishes to see you.
So Expedia is a travel company. They have a airline website, hotel website. I believe they also own hotels.com, and they might also own Vrbo. And so a lot of the reason why Expedia has been down recently is because of this perception that consumers are burning through their savings, which is true, and that travel will hurt as a result. So in the most recent earnings report in May, Expedia reported slower revenue growth, but that was pretty much the only bad side of it. Otherwise, their earnings look pretty good. If you look at their debt levels, $6 billion on a $14 billion market cap company, but a lot of that is pushed out. A lot of the interest is pretty low, so they're actually only 6x on interest coverage ratio. They can perfectly afford the debt that they have. Their cash flow improved in the wake of the pandemic, as you'd expect. Their profitability increased over the past year. And so the question becomes, what is your belief on travel? I personally am of the opinion that maybe this would be a good opportunity to pick up companies like Expedia. Because if you take a look at a survey from the TSA on Memorial Day, it was actually the busiest day on record for flights within the United States. Travel doesn't seem to be hurting yet. So if the narrative continues that travel is going to be hurt, especially where Expedia is priced at now at a price to earnings of 8 and a price to book value pretty high, but still a price to earnings of 8 times, I think now might actually be a good time. I think the market is pricing in the consumer not being able to spend as much on travel. And so far, that really hasn't borne out. Now we're heading into a short break. Feel free to give me a call anytime at 888-99-CHART.
Invest Talk Wealth Webinar is coming up soon. Tuesday, June 11th, join Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero as they explore the aspects of quality investing. It's all happening online. Register now at investtalk.com.
Let's turn our eyes to my, or really our ears for those of you listening, to my main focus point, which concerns this topic. Five key lessons taken from the study of U.S. financial history. Research compiled for a new book reveals five overarching themes, such as appreciation of the bipolar peril of price instability and recognizing the long wave cycles of alternative asset classes. Because it's of interest to academics, trustees, and institutions, it should also be of interest to you. So let's talk a little bit about U.S. financial history and asset classes and really what public credit means and how it can inform our investment decisions. Well, let's take a step back and talk about why this is coming about. After about 4 years of research covering the financial history of the United States from the late 18th century to modern times, historian and investment advisor Mark J. Higgins has authored a book called Investing in U.S. Financial History, Understanding the Past to Forecast the Future. And what he did, essentially, was amass a vast collection of 3,000 note cards from hundreds of sources, which lined the walls of his basement and helped him write a book which aimed to distill complex historical data into insights in order to make financial foresight and decision-making easier for ordinary investors. Higgins, in his book, points out several key lessons for investors, emphasizing the importance of understanding historical financial patterns to better prepare for future market extremes. And so, I'm not here to say go get this book. What I'm here to say is there are five main insights that are important to talk about. So what are they? The first is normalizing extreme market events. Higgins, in a way, kind of highlights that financial crises throughout the United States history help us to understand the patterns that help investors not only allocate before, during, and after, but maintain calm during those turbulent times. We talk about this a lot. In one of our wealth webinars, I showed a graph, and that graph showed you historically how long it takes from market crises, market instability, to full drawdown, to eventually getting back to where we started. And the main lesson there isn't to help you time the amount of time it takes on average, because I don't believe that that would be helpful at all. The main lesson there is that historically crises happen. Often, no two crises are the same. We get better at putting in regulatory frameworks that help prevent them. But either way, the best way to get through a crisis is if you can, if your investment horizon is long enough, maintain your presence in the market. You don't know when the recovery will happen. You can't predict when the recovery will happen. But historically, if you're able to keep in the market during the downturn and for the recovery, you're no worse off than you were before. Secondarily, talks about price instability and how the Federal Reserve's past policy mistakes, particularly around the Great Depression and the great inflationary period of the 70s, had a critical impact on economic stability. That's pretty relevant today. Now you have a market that wants more than anything rate cuts. But what's the problem with cutting rates prematurely? What would be the problem with an incorrect move by the Federal Reserve? Well, it could bring back inflationary pressures in a very powerful way. So it's important to note, they say it all the time, don't fight the Fed. that understanding monetary policy helps you understand where the economy is going. In a similar way, public credit is important. Higgins points out that the past 60 years is really an aberration compared to the history of the United States. Where our fiscal decisions have put us in terms of public debt is a perilous position. And so it's important that we pressure our leaders to steer us back into fiscal sustainability. Another lesson is that, generally speaking, active management, which really wasn't a big thing until 1934, when you had a lot of corporate filing requirements come into place, for most people does not do as good a job as passive investment strategies. Now, you've seen today a lot of active ETFs come into place that have outperformed passive investment strategies, and that's because they can rebalance, tilt towards areas that have drifted away in style from those passive indices. But generally speaking, individual stock picking for the ordinary investor that doesn't make it their life's work, their job, it's just something they do on the side, doesn't work. And lastly, there has been in the past couple years, really the past couple decades, as institutions and pensions have shifted towards allocating heavily towards alternative assets, a desire for ordinary investors such as yourself, such as myself, to want to go that way and invest in alternative asset classes as well. Well, these asset classes have a couple things in common. One, they're illiquid. Their pricing power, the information within those prices, how accurate those prices are because of the illiquidity, are less accurate than the things that we have in public markets. But because they're illiquid, because they're harder to invest in, you've had people turn towards those, investment managers turn towards those asset classes and offer them to the investing public. And because of the nature of them, they charge more. And so realizing that alternative asset classes that maybe in the past have done a good job of providing outsized returns, over the past 50 years, that hasn't really been the case. The historical tendency has shifted given the overcrowded nature and, frankly, the illiquid nature of these markets, and that problem not really being solved in the past couple decades. Honestly, it's an old cliche, but it's true. Those who don't understand their history are doomed to repeat it. The same is the case for understanding what affects financial markets and economic cycles. Now, on the next Invest Talk, we'll look into this story, Investor Behavior Continues to Hinder Returns. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and I'm ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
Let's say you've been thinking about learning a new language. Okay, why? I mean, how would it come in handy? And where would you want to use it? Could it be that you have an upcoming international trip? Or maybe you want to connect with family members or friends from a different culture? I think you should know about Rosetta Stone. With millions of users, it's been the world's most trusted language learning program for 30 years. Rosetta Stone is available on your desktop or as an app with audio companion and the ability to download lessons offline. Rosetta Stone truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. It has a built-in, patented speech recognition engine called True Accent. So as you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you pronounce words. With Rosetta Stone, you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's an intuitive process designed for long-term retention. You really learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. Rosetta Stone is an amazing value, so your special skill set is within easy reach. You know you want to do this, so don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, InvestTalk listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off now at rosettastone.com/today. At this point, I think almost everyone has heard how generative AI promises to bring us to the next industrial revolution. AI is already shaping society with an impact on daily life that echoes the transformative significance of electricity or the internet. As we take steps to embrace the potential of generative AI, we need to remain vigilant with regard to its exploitability. This is where HackerOne comes in. HackerOne's AI Red Team addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses that are launching new AI deployments. The HackerOne approach involves targeted offensive testing by harnessing the collective skills of ethical hackers who are proficient in AI and prompt hacking. In short, AI red teaming is the practice of stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. HackerOne seamlessly integrates with your existing tools to enhance communication and collaboration across development, security, and IT teams. So, stay ahead of the game in the battle against cyber threats with HackerOne's Attack Resistance Platform. Learn more at HackerOne.com. That's HackerOne.com, HackerOne.com.
You've got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Luke or Justin, I've got a question about ResMed, ticker RMD. I actually stumbled upon this stock in October of last year after trying to find one of my clients' required minimum distributions, plugged in RMD in the search bar, and up came ResMed. I noticed that in Q4, it missed earnings by maybe 9 cents, and the stock just completely plummeted from in the 200s down to in the 130s to 150s. That's when I started to buy it. And I checked the other day, and it looks like the stock ripped back up above 200. I have not had time to look into the reasoning why it's missed earnings and plummeted to the degree that it did in October and why it's ripping now. So I was hoping to hear your thoughts on that and just overall opinion of the company. Thank you so much. I'll listen on the podcast.
So that's hilarious because when I saw that the question was on ticker RMD, I asked my producer, are we talking about required minimum distributions? But alas, we are not. We are talking about ResMed, which is a digital health and cloud-connected medical devices company. And when I'm looking at this company, the first thing that draws my attention to it is pretty significant cash flow growth over the past year. At the same time, they've been issuing some shares, though not too many, and they've been getting some pretty significant earnings upgrades. Now, as the caller mentioned, the relative strength did kind of drop off a little bit, but it's since recovered towards the end of 2023. And overall, it looks like a pretty healthy company. Sales growth, 12.5% over the past 5 years on average. And that's not really sliced into any individual year over year with outsized growth. That's pretty consistent. In terms of debt, about $1.5 billion on a $30 billion market cap company. Earnings per share in 22 was 5.3, then 6.09 last year. Supposed to be 7.73 this year and 8.75 next year. But we need to take a look at its relative valuation. Its price to earnings, about 23. Which is pretty low compared to its five-year average, probably because of that steep price drop-off towards the end of last year. Its price to book, it's currently trading at a 6.6, all pretty reasonable valuations. You know, it's down about 4% on the past year, but it's still up about 20% year-to-date. Overall, I like where the company is going. I like the sales growth. It's been pretty consistent. I like their margins that have been increasing. They had a margin of 21% last year. They're projected to have a margin of 22.2% next year. It's a pretty reasonable valuation as well. You know, honestly, I think I got to give this one a thumbs up. That's RMD, ResMed, not required minimum distributions. Now let's shift gears and talk a little bit about a Fed survey that came out. And what this survey showed is that U.S. economic activity continued to expand from early April through mid-May. And that's according to firms who, regardless of it, are still growing increasingly pessimistic about the future due to that weakening consumer demand. And so This ongoing expansion comes as inflation continues to rise pretty modestly, which has prompted some central bankers to deliberate the duration for maintaining current interest rates. This survey, which is known as the Beige Book, is released roughly once every 6 weeks, and it highlights a gradually cooling job market, which is good. The job market has been too hot. It's now moving towards more normalized levels. And the reason why this is important is because this information is pretty crucial for policymakers to decide whether or not what they've done for the past 10 months, which is keep interest rates between 5.25 and 5.50%, is what they're going to do moving forward. So how is this survey conducted? Well, it's polling business contacts across the Fed's 12 districts up until May 20th for this most recent survey. And it's an indication of economic conditions across both industries and across districts. Overall, the outlook's been somewhat pessimistic amid a rising uncertainties and increased downside risks, especially because of geopolitical tensions and the potential for ongoing Middle East conflicts. Consumer spending trends are a particular concern. Most districts reported only slight or modest growth. Some actually noted no change at all. Retail spending, for instance, flat to slightly up, aligning with data that suggests consumers are curtailing their spending on consumer products. Officials, however, were cautious after unexpected price hikes earlier in the year indicated substantial, consistent positive inflation data would be needed before any rate reductions would be considered. There are indications that inflationary pressures might be picking up again. Many districts observed ongoing increases in input costs, the most important of costs, that's what they typically are looking at. And a separate survey indicated a surge in May's prices of various manufacturing inputs, which overall probably suggests some potential future rises in good inflation. First it hits the producers, then it hits the consumers. Consumer behavior, which the survey also looks at, is shifting. Many are becoming more price sensitive, which could impact profit margins, revenues, and profits down the road for companies. Earnings, as you recall, has been really one of the things that has stabilized beyond artificial intelligence this market rally. Now, on a positive note, as I mentioned at the top, the labor market is showing signs of improvement with slight overall increases of employment. There's better labor availability in most districts and reduced employee turnover. Wage growth, while still moderate, has reportedly returned to pre-pandemic averages. Wages tend to be what really drives inflation in the long term. And so despite the slowest U.S. job gains in 6 months as of April, and annual wage increases falling below 4% for the first time in nearly 3 years, the labor market really remains relatively tight. All of these factors will continue to have a large impact going forward, so it's important to continue to monitor these things, which happen to be the key drivers of inflation. Now, I hope you've been telling your friends that our InvestTalk audio podcast is also posted in video form on our YouTube channel. And it seems that every day now we receive finance and investment questions from the comment section of our InvestTalk YouTube channel. So here's one that came in recently. The question is, what are your thoughts on MELI stock? Let's pull it up. MELI, Mercado Libre Inc., is a Latin American, let's call it Amazon. It's a Latin American Amazon. They engage in the development of online e-commerce platforms and also focus on financial technology for payment processing. So MELI has been growing pretty significantly, and not just in terms of their sales growth, their revenue, not just in terms of their margins, but also in terms of how the business operates. So it's now, within the past couple weeks, delivering 80% of its orders within 2 days. Recall that that's one of the things people like the best about Amazon, Walmart Plus, all these things. It's about being able to buy your goods online and get your goods delivered to you fairly quickly. The company's fintech segment has also grown by triple digits over the past year. And so taking a look at their debt levels, pretty modest, $2.8 billion. On an $86 billion market cap company. Again, their sales growth is outstanding. Their five-year annualized growth rate is 58.7%. And their return on equity is pretty good. 40% is projected to be 36 this year. Their margins, their net margin increasing from 4.6 2 years ago to 6.8 last year, projected to be 9.2 this year. All of these things look good. My only issue with this company, which, by the way, is up 33% in 1 year. My only issue with this company is something that you have to worry about sometimes with companies in the developing world. And that is Latin American companies. Remember, their primary revenue stream comes from Latin American companies. I think Argentina, let's see. Yeah, Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico, 52%, 22%, and 20% respectively. Latin American countries have volatile economies. And Mercado Libre is headquartered in Uruguay. And like this shows, one of its main markets is Argentina. And both of those countries have their issues. Argentina has its own economic crises of late. Brazil, its other leading market, has interest rate and inflation issues. So for me, investing in a company whose primary business model is predicated upon purchasing by consumers, e-commerce, in countries that are having economic crises, it's a little risky for me. It's had a great year. It certainly has. I think its growth is very impressive. But if you can stomach the risk, if you have a risk appetite that allows you to invest in a company such as this, which could have a political uncertainty, regulatory uncertainty, and economic uncertainty just because of the region that it operates and the region that it's domiciled in, then yeah, it could be a good company. But just understand the risks if you're investing in this company. Thanks for watching. Now, this is InvestTalk, now with more than 58 million downloads, and our work continues in 30 seconds. Feel free to give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
The next InvestTalk Wealth webinar is coming up soon, Tuesday, June 11th. It's all happening online, and it's free. Join Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero as they explore the aspects of quality investing and why it's essential to look beyond high dividend yields. The InvestTalk Wealth webinar, Quality Investing, Digging Deeper Than Dividends. June 11th, 1 to 2 Pacific Time. Register now at investtalk.com.
Hi, Luke and Justin. I hope you're both well. My name is Onur. I'm from Kansas City, and I'm interested in investing long-term. I have a question about stock valuation, particularly regarding the P/E ratio. Are there simple rules or formulas that you guys use both with the P/E ratio along with one or two other metrics? For instance, I was wondering if consistent 10% earnings growth could justify a P/E ratio of 10. I know this is oversimplistic, but I'm curious if you have any guidelines to initially assess a stock before diving into a more detailed analysis. I would appreciate any advice you could give. Thank you very much.
So the question is surrounding how to, if I'm getting this correctly, essentially do a first pass. So before diving in to an individual company, the technical aspects of it, the fundamental aspects of it, how can you sort through and have criteria based on valuation, which is a good first pass criteria, of what to look at? Some people use price to earnings. I like price to book value historically. Doing any sort of market valuation to fundamental valuation multiple essentially gives you mostly the same results. The reason why price to book works well is because it's primarily based on the market value of essentially the company's assets relative to the assets that it owns. So that is more of a pure, if you will, way to look at relative valuation, whereas price to earnings incorporates analyst estimates, it incorporates forward-looking guidance, it incorporates profitability. And so if you're trying to look at relative valuation, I prefer to look at price to book, enterprise value to EBITDA. Now, keeping that in mind, there is no one-size-fits-all rule. Why is that? Because different sectors are going to have different types of price to earnings ranges because different sectors are growthier. You're going to find way higher price to earnings in tech sectors, in the tech sector, than you are in materials. And that's just the nature of the business. You should be willing to take on a higher price to earnings multiple if you have higher sustainable good growth. And I mean good growth because I don't mean one-off ancillary growth. I mean real growth that is consistent, real growth that is within the primary operating area of that business. And so if I were to give you one piece of advice, it is to think about like-kind companies, and your best friend is comparable analysis. Look at averages of the sector, look at averages of the sub-industry, look at averages of like companies, and that will tell you how the company you're looking at relates to the overall industry and sector as a whole. Thanks for the call. Now let's talk a little bit about oil. Oil is still the primary lifeblood of the economy. And so who maintains this market? Who controls supply and pricing in this market? Historically, it's been OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And they produce over 40% of the world's crude, and they aim to maintain high yet stable oil prices. Which is interesting because despite recent geopolitical tensions, such as the death of Iran's president and the escalating conflict in Gaza, crude prices have remained stable, around $82 a barrel, since early May. Their struggle to elevate these prices is partly due to members not adhering to output targets. Despite agreeing to cut production, some countries are actually increasing production. And several factors contribute to these moderated oil prices outside of that. The easing of tensions between Iran and Israel has reduced the risk premium on oil. But an important part of it is growth from regions that haven't historically produced as much oil. The U.S., in particular, has entered the market in a big way. And so OPEC has overproduced since the new cuts took effect in January, exceeding quotas every month and contributing to global oil stock rebuilds. The overshooting is pretty significant, with some countries, Iraq, Kazakhstan, for example, consistently ignoring their production limits. Russia has been less compliant as well, probably due to the financial strains of ongoing military engagements. And even Saudi Arabia, typically OPEC's enforcer, has slightly exceeded its quotas. And so this group's ability to control oil prices is further complicated by internal disagreements over these quotas. Looking ahead, the situation may become even more strained in 2025 when additional oil supplies from non-OPEC countries are expected, like the US, Canada, places in South America. In the near term, demand for oil is likely to increase as refineries resume these operations. But with all output cuts set to expire by 2025, ongoing disputes are going to become more and more relevant. And regardless of all of this, with America in a position where it's never produced more oil, and other countries in the Western Hemisphere following suit, it's unclear what power OPEC, which has dominated energy and oil markets over the past several decades, will have over the next decade and onward. Now, this is InvestTalk, and I'm Luke Guerrero, and we have one goal here, and that is to help you achieve your financial freedom. And our work continues after this break, so get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey guys, this is Kevin calling from Southern California. Thanks for your show and always giving us a lot of information and education. My question today is about Modine Manufacturing. M-O-D is the ticker. I've held this for a while. I got it under 60. And then I've taken profits along the way up to like 110. After earnings, it dropped down to 90-ish range. That's kind of come back down now. I wanted to pick up more shares of this stock, and I'm trying to figure out where you think would be a good buying point, which are your technical and fundamental analysis based on the earnings was. Hopefully you can give me an idea of when I should get back. I still hold some, but I just wanted to get some more of it. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
So Modine Manufacturing Company, MOD, engages in the provision of thermal management products and solutions. And what that means is they specialize in HVAC products, but also in EV heat exchange systems so that you can prolong the battery life of batteries in electric vehicles, and also the storage of energy itself. So let's dive in a little bit. Growth over the past 5 years, pretty modest, 1.7% annualized over the past 5 years. Their long-term debt situation, about $400 million on a $5.2 billion market cap company. Their cash flow, improving pretty steadily. Their profitability looks like it's improving as well. Their net margins were negative in 2021. Then they turned a profit in 2022 at 4.2%, then 5, then 6. They're projected 7.5% this year. From a relative valuation perspective, it's pretty expensive given their revenue growth, 28 times, which is well above their five-year average of about 10. It's actually outside their range of the past 5 years. I'm sorry, 26. So it's just at their range of the past 5 years. It's price to book 7, which is just below the high of its range over the past 5 years as well. You know, for me, this company would be an instrumental part of a vehicular transition, certainly companies like this, but it's a little too expensive, especially given the fact that it's not doing much revenue growth, and that's over the past 5 years. I would probably wait to see it come down towards the, towards the 80 range. I'd wait until it comes down to the 80 range, comes down to a more reasonable valuation, especially given what we talked about earlier. You should be willing to pay for higher priced earnings companies if you see that revenue growth. This seems to be projecting out future growth to a large extent. So I would certainly wait for it to come down a bit. It looks a little overvalued to me. You know, I think we can get one more question in before we head off for the day. This one came in earlier from a listener in Ohio.
Hello, InvestTalk. Calling from Ohio, early morning in the gym. It's where I listen to you guys every day. I'm calling about a follow-up, a comment Justin made on Canadian oil companies. I currently own Ovintiv, OVV, and it's done well for me. And it's recently pulled back from a high around 55, 56. Now it's around 48 today. Looking to see if this is one of the companies that might benefit from this new pipeline. If I should add more or if I should try to look for this other Canadian company that you guys might be looking into. I'm always interested to hear you guys' thoughts. So I'll listen on the show. Thanks. Bye.
So Ovintiv is an integrated oil company. They engage in the production, development of oil, natural gas liquids, and natural gas producing plays. The revenue growth, first and foremost, stellar, about 14% over the past 5 years. Now, a lot of that came in 2018 to 2020, and it did drop off a little bit at the end of 2022. But taking a look at their margins, yeah, they suffered a little bit as well. Its return on equity dropped from about 57% in 2022. To about 23%. All energy companies tended to do pretty well in that area. Their cash flow, pretty steady over the past 3 years. Profitability, pretty stable after dropping off. You know, I don't really recall what Justin's comments were, and I'm not sure if this company is the one he was talking about in particular, but from a relative valuation perspective, it seems pretty undervalued. Trading at a 1.3 price to book, 7.1%. Or rather 7.1 times price to earnings. I don't have any problems with it. It's up 11% over the past year, or rather year to date, up 42% over the past year. Again, maybe call back. Call Justin live and ask him if this is what he was talking about. I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another InvestTalk program. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads. Get yours anytime at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. I also want to let you know that the next InvestTalk Wealth webinar is coming up pretty fast. It's happening online, June 11th. So learn more and register now at investtalk.com. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial.